Welcome to another episode of the Mind Hack Books podcast. We're discussing the sequel to the sci-fi classic Dune, Dune Messiah from 1969, 337 pages, which is about half of the first book. Joining me is Paolo. You have to be here for the sequels of Dune.
I signed a contract.
You cannot die until you review all Dune book existence.
Well, I mean, are we including like all of the weird spin-offs that are still coming out?
We might.
Okay.
We might.
All right.
Then at that point, you'll be a Gholai already.
Yeah, probably.
And because we love Dune so much, and we've recorded our 50th episode in two parts, we're talking about this so much, and I think we might be slightly biased, and we might be fanboying out just a little bit. So to counterbalance this inequality, I asked Christina to come.
Hello.
Thank you. So I hope that you will be the voice of reason in our fanatic, mad view of Dune.
I'm very happy to play the straight man to your fanboy. Yeah. Like full disclosure, I liked Dune very much. I read it for the first time when I was much too young for it. I think I must have been like 12, 13.
What?
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yes, I have an older brother, and he got the books.
Damn, girl.
Yeah, and like there were things that I like didn't get, and I assumed it was because I was too young. And some of them I didn't get because I was too young, and some of them I didn't get because they're just weird.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, of course.
Like the drug... like a drug and orgy party the Fremen have.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what did you think about orgies at 12 years old? Like, what the hell?
Classic things that you want to read.
So maybe you should cut this out, but it's a funny personal anecdote that you might want to cut out. When I was like 11 years old, I got this series of books by Jean M. Owl. I don't know how you pronounce it. It's spelled A-U-E-L. About the lives of prehistoric people, particularly one girl. And I think my dad read the first book.
Okay.
And then he didn't read the rest of the books. Because as the girl grew up, they got explicit. It took me a while until I realized that was not a misspelling of organism.
Okay.
You know, so I don't think I like worried too much about spice orgies. I don't actually remember those, so I might have just skipped it or not. I don't know, but
I see.
Okay. Yeah.
I didn't know you. You are prescient and awakened by Dune Spice initiated since such a young age.
Don't get me started on Alia this early. Don't. I have things to say about Alia and the treatment she gets.
Yeah.
So how many Dune books have you read?
I read the first one, I read this one, I read Children of Dune, and then I read the one where Leto is a worm.
Yeah, Dune
God
Emperor.
Yeah, Emperor. And there's some girl who's like his Ganymas, like offspring from like 100 generations.
Yeah, like,
and I didn't like that very much.
That's my favorite.
Yeah. Love that.
I mean,
so
like the fourth one, like I wanted to say this later, but the fourth one is like the most controversial one, like or like not controversial,
exactly
controversial,
like
but like polarizing. Some people really love it, and some people really, really hate it.
I love weirdness when it makes sense, and it's very rare.
Yeah, it's very easy to hate. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Christina listened to parts of our discussion about the first book, and I asked her, "Is there anything she would add to disagree, or are there even more reasons why the book is so good that we didn't cover?"
One thing that like I found applicable from Dune to my own life is the litany against fear.
Yes, I had the same.
That is just like, yeah, it works if you calm down and you like, you know. I think that is excellent for people who might suffer from anxiety or just facing some kind of a scary situation.
I have to absolutely agree.
Yeah.
But thanks. You are very welcome. You said that. I'm not sure what exactly the misquote you, but if you haven't read Dune, you wouldn't be on this podcast. So, I mean, people who haven't read it and didn't like it, they wouldn't be talking to us probably. So that's why we're here. So I guess let's get into the Dune Messiah sequel. If you haven't read the first book, I don't know what you're doing here. I have to say this, get Arrow here, where are we? Just get to episode 50, listen to that one first. You have no idea what the first book is about. Be gone. Watch the movie. If you read the first one and are thinking about reading the second one, I would wholeheartedly say stop listening and try it.
Yeah.
Because it's very short compared to the first one. If you've already gotten through the first one, this one is so much easier to read, so much faster to read, so much shorter to read. And you might like it a lot, and if you hate it, you might need to read it, because I think it's something we said in the previous episode, June 1, that it's a thing that people not necessarily want, but I think they need.
I agree with you in the fact that people should read it, if only by the fact that it's basically like an ending to the story of the first one. Like, that's what I've been saying to everyone.
I was listening to an interview, and Frank Herbert said that they accused him that he made Paul into an anti-hero, supervillain, whatever, something. And he said that the only difference of making a character a hero or an anti-hero or a villain is where you stop the story.
Yeah.
So after the first book, like Paul is saying, the story is not done. So.
Yeah, but I do disagree with you on one point, because you said it's easier to read than Dune. I know, like, we had like divergent opinions on this. Like, to me, the first Dune was not particularly hard to read. It was not as easy as other books, but like fairly standard. The second one to me was much, much harder to read. In a sense, it was a relief that it was this short, because had it been like 600 pages like the first one, it would have been much, much harder to me, at least.
Mm. What would it be about if it was 600 pages? That would be a slog.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it was easier to read. I think first Dune, you are reading what is a familiar narrative. Mm. You know, the focus on politics, on political intrigue, which I think a lot of fantasy books outside of G.R.R. Martin don't really go that deep into it. That was something I enjoyed about Dune a lot, the intrigue and politics and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But we also mentioned that about the writer, that he has a lot of experience with politics, and that's why he can write well.
I found that kind of lacking in Dune 2. That felt more like a personal narrative of this man who now has all the responsibility, and that felt like a very personal story.
The second one, you mean? The second one, okay.
I didn't feel as political to me.
Okay.
Yes and no, it was a little bit different angle, like more focused on the religion and like what it takes to be this kind of figure in the eyes of the people and all that. So yes and no.
I mean, it does revolve like all around a conspiracy and about the different political powers like in this universe. So in a way, like, to me, at least, the first one was a bit more personal in the sense that it was a path of like personal growth for the main character. The second one is more of a coming to terms in more practical ways with what happened in the first book.
But I don't recall Paul actually wielding his political power
that's
very
true.
Much. Making any that's kind true. Of decisions about the running of the massive empire. The first book, I'd say, is more political in the sense that it's about navigating politics and gaining political power. And if I remember correctly, it ends once Paul becomes the emperor. He marries the princess, becomes the emperor, and that's it. And okay, so how do you run the universe? Yeah. And well, that might be a bit of a boring read.
But
Paul going like, right. Okay, we need more public toilets, you know.
Did it feel relatable to you? Like, on a personal level, somehow?
No.
It's okay. I'm just curious.
Well, I mean, not too much, but I guess it feels relatable just in the sense of sometimes, you know, you have this feeling of inevitability which kind of like permeates the whole book.
That was the most dreading feeling I got out of this, and that's why I read it so quickly, or it felt so fast, because it felt somehow very personal to me. I don't know why. This dreading, like growing heavy feeling throughout the whole thing. And you know it's not going to end well from the very beginning. Like, you kind of knew it's not going to end well even at the end of the first book, if you thought about it a little bit. And most people didn't care about that, like the consequences and repercussions about like what happens after you become the ruler of the universe. And that's why people kind of hated or were shocked when they read the sequel. So I kind of expected it, and I was primed for some, I don't know, I keep saying depression, but like some dark something. And it still got me, even though I was expecting it to be bad. Like, I was expecting Paul to get it bad hard. And I didn't expect it to feel so bad about it. Like, it was, I felt kind of crushed.
Yeah.
And some thought processes that Paul has in the book, and some like mental athletics he goes through to justify or make certain decisions that cannot be made with a clear conscience in any sense, felt very, very real to me, that I went through similar thought processes in life. Like, you can't have anything good come out of this. How do you deal with this? And not only making the decision, but what happens afterward, and you have to live with it. So that's kind of the whole feeling of this book that I got. And that's why I couldn't stop reading it, because I was like, first of all, I want to have this done. I don't want to think about this anymore because it's so depressing. Second of all, I want to know what happens and what he does. And finally, it's kind of kept me going. I couldn't get out of it, like, when I was thinking about it. So usually I try to find like a tidbit about the writer or about the release of the book or something. I wasn't able to find anything fun. The only thing I wrote was that Frank Herbert got married 3 times. And Christina wrote, she's shocked.
Yeah, that was ironic. I hope that came across. I was shocked.
Why are all these writers married so many times? Like Philip K. Dick, we talked about recently, he married 5 times.
I don't know of these writers, but if he treated his wives the same way that he wrote the female characters in this one, then I'm not that surprised.
Oh no.
I guess I'll get to it when the time comes. Once I started noticing, paying attention to what was said about the women, I couldn't stop noticing it. And I wish I hadn't noticed, because it kind of spoiled my enjoyment of the book. Because like every time Irulan came on screen, Chaney, I was like, yeah, Paul is a dick.
That's true. I mean, for Irulan, like in particular, I do think that the goal was to kind of like ridicule her. So it was very much intentional. But it is true that in the first few books, like the female characters are not treated particularly well. Although, I mean, I think Jessica in the first book it's a good character.
I liked her.
Yeah, but like you can see that sometimes, like especially Paul treats her like an idiot, and sometimes she behaves like an idiot.
It's not always about the way that they get treated by the characters, but sometimes just the way that they are written. I'll made a note here. This is from page 33 of my ebook.
Okay.
Chaney moved with an ageless air of fragile power, so self-contained, so vulnerable. What is that? Like, in the first book, she felt like somebody who was quite energetic, quite independent, who would take initiative.
Yeah.
Right? That's the way. And in this book, she disappears behind Angela's great air of fragile power. What does that mean?
That's a good question.
You know, well, do we spoil the book and say
no, not yet.
Say but, like what the purpose of Chaney is in this book?
To spoil like the third book, Chaney is a redhead. It's never mentioned until the third book, but yeah.
I completely blanked out that
it's said only in the third book. Like, one of the cool parts about Dune is that the characters are never described. Like, only some small details are, like, for example, Duncan Idaho's hair get described a lot, but because they're very sexy.
Yeah.
But I will say this. Many people accuse Frank Herbert of being very conservative when it comes to women and, like, homosexuality. I do think you can see mm-hmm. his evolution throughout the books, especially in the last book. Essentially, it's all about the women. So I do think he changed. He evolved.
We'll get back to you on that. one day we'll make it to book six. Just a quick mention, this book and the sequel, Children of Dune, was adapted by Sci-Fi as a quick TV show, which is really weird. Have you seen it?
I have, with Czech actors.
What do you think?
I like it. I saw it as a child. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, it's not bad. Like, some if you're a fan, I recommend it.
It's pretty good. Other people say it's awful.
It is awful and it's pretty good. Like, you know, it's kind of like the production values are very low. many things are simplified. You know, your imagination might run a little wild, especially with Golas and Telaxu and like the tigers in the third book and all
tigers
this. Like,
in the third book.
It looks a little amazing in your mind. And then you see it in this television show.
I can't wait to talk about the tigers in the third book.
But if
we should have an hour episode just on the tigers.
So, but I would, if you're a fan of the books, I think it's definitely amusing, and at parts very surprising, and at parts actually good, and at parts very bad. So it's like a mix of, but it's enjoyable. I enjoyed it.
I think the acting is good.
Yeah.
Overall, I think the acting is quite good.
And another tidbit is that Denis, and now Pablo, correct me, Denis Villeneuve is the director of the new Dune movie. So he said in 2021 that he wants to film and adapt Dune Messiah as well. And then he reconfirmed it in 2023, I found recently, that he really, really wants to go for it and film this.
I don't think it's going to
movie.
Happen.
So what do you think about this? Can this be made?
It's not the type of story that would go well as a movie. I think especially true for the fourth book.
Yeah, that one day the fourth book will be filmed and I'll be so happy.
No, like, so I think like the first and the third would do really well as movies or TV shows. The second and the fourth, I think they would do so much better as like stage plays, because like it's so much more about, you know, the inner thoughts and introspection and
I like this book because it's a perfect slap in the face for people who expect the hero story and the person to become an even stronger superhero. And I like to be positive, even though sometimes it's super naive, and I like to believe that this movie will happen, the Dune Messiah will happen, and it's going to be the slap in the face of Marvel fans. It's going to save cinema, because after this movie, people will see that there can be a good movie that's a huge production, that has something to say, has a message, is introspective, and is thoughtful, not like recent movies. So if that happens, I would be so happy.
I don't think so, but I mean, I'm more than happy to watch it. I don't think people would like it so much.
So before we get into the plot, I have one last recommendation to people who are still listening and haven't read it and might be thinking to read it. I've been thinking about it. I've been trying to like go over what books I've read and blah, blah, blah. And I believe, for me personally, this has the best villain in fiction ever. For me personally. I'm so excited to talk about his character. I'm sure I'm giving him too much credit, and some things I think he's done he hasn't done, but personally, this is the best villain I remember any story ever in this book. At least for now, until this episode on this podcast, I would like to give it the title of the best villain. I'm gonna call this...
Well, it is your podcast, so you can hand the prize to whoever you want.
It's gonna change, and it's not just me deciding, so if you come up to a book that we cover and it's a better villain, then please, the title is not just one time. So I'm gonna give the BMF title to either how did you say it? Skitail?
Well, I say Scytail, but
Scytail?
I don't know. Okay, Scytail, Skytail. I'm sure there's pronunciation guides.
I always imagined it's like a scythe. It's gonna cut you up.
I always decided so. I don't care about official pronunciations. I just care about what I call them in my mind. So yeah, it's Scytail.
So I came up with 10 points why Scytail is the biggest, baddest MFR in this story. So tune in for that on the spoiler section.
Are we not saying motherfucker?
I was trying not to, but okay.
Okay.
So on to the spoilers. The book starts 12 years after the first book.
Yeah.
So Paul, like we already talked about, he became the leader actually and spiritually, and I don't really know in all the ways.
Secularly and spiritually.
Okay, thank you, Haikun.
He is the best, yes. Better than all the rest.
And he had these visions in the first book that we didn't know anything about. We mentioned them, something about the jihad, mm-hmm. which when I was reading about it, like especially the first book, I was like, I don't have any idea what this means. Until it was explained in the second book, because I'm dumb. So it's from Arabic, and it's a word for struggle.
I don't think like it's used in that sense. It's used like in a sense of holy war.
Yes, that's what I was coming to. I just wanted to like say that.
So and it has become kind of a sensitive word because it was used a lot by terrorists. So yes. That is why in the movie it's actually crusade. They don't say jihad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're far more removed from crusades, which were delightful.
So like we already mentioned, Paul is coming to the realization that he's put in motion something that cannot be stopped, whichever way he can try to stop it.
Yeah.
And he finds out in his visions or beliefs that humanity, unless something radical changes, humanity is just doomed. It will it will just degrade in stagnation, self-destruction. Everything will go to ruin if things continue as he put them in motion.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole book is him trying to find the best way of least evil and trying to make something out of the worst situation he's been put in, and also come to terms with what he's become and trying to escape it. And that's why Christina said he doesn't really want to take part in any of this politicizing or in the politics. I think he wants to just get out of it. He doesn't really want to deal with it. And that's why in the book, Alia has to talk to the people in the public, and she's kind of bothered with it.
Yeah. She's the head of the church, I mean, she's think.
She was kind of like the figurehead for the church. A couple of things. So first, the very start of the book is actually the letter of the political prisoner from X. I don't know if you remember this.
Mm.
Yeah, so this was one of my favorite parts of the whole book. Probably this, like the first, okay. like, two or three pages where there is like this letter, and then the very ending of the book are probably my favorite parts. You can just read that, and that basically tells you all about the book. It's like this letter by this guy who was arrested is from X, which is like the other faction, which is not discussed in this book, but which will be very important in the fourth book. And he's arrested essentially because he dared say that, you know, Paul is a tyrant. And then, you know, people are just fanatics, and like his followers are just fanatics. And he's, of course, right on everything. But, you know, again, the fact that the book starts, like the last thing you've read, if you finish reading like Dune, the first one, and, you know, you had like this hero story and you have kind of like this sort of happy ending. And then literally the first thing you read in the second one is like, this guy's a jerk.
That's great.
Like, you know, we really don't like him. And I'm being arrested like for the sole reason that I dared to say that. I think it's a really, really strong way to start a book. Yeah,
that's true.
I really agree. Liked it.
Yeah, I wouldn't say he was correct on everything. Maybe this wasn't in the letter. This was in the other part where there's the communication between interrogator, like jailer, and the author. The way he speaks about the Fremen, as though they were, well, what he says is, he dazzled you with such visions, he took your virginity. Which, okay, it's a funny way to say it, and also I don't think it's true, because the Fremen, they were not helpless, they were not some naive figures waiting for somebody to show them the way. They were doing pretty well by themselves, and then Paul came, and basically he had the superpower of being Paul Atreides, having the political power and having the power of the visions given to him by the spice. So he's the one who, like, helped them. But that's I wouldn't say he took their virginity as though before he came, they were just completely helpless and innocent. Like, they were not.
Yeah, they were not innocent.
Killing people, fighting, you know, in the guerrilla warfare, you know, they were doing okay.
He became their messiah. He became kind of their god in the literal sense. And he fulfilled all of their beliefs. And they were kind of pushed into this state of just worshipping him, which I think is what they're trying to say.
In the first book, you know, as Christina said, the Fremen were doing well for themselves and they were starting to terraform Dune. But they also said that this would take generations and generations and generations and maybe like hundreds of years for it to come by. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Paul arrives and essentially everything is done in job's done.
Job
like
starts.
20 years.
Yeah.
Okay, finished. We're here already. Like, in a way, you could say, well, isn't this a good thing? Like, instead of having to wait 300 years to see their dreams come true, they can have it like in 20, 30 years. But it's kind of symbolizing the relying too much on external support and external assistance, so that now you're completely dependent on that assistance. And yeah, sure, you got what you wanted in a much shorter amount of time, but
so that's I think the virginity, the dependence.
I mean, you're right, it's still like not the best phrasing.
Yeah. So basically everybody hates Paul. Everybody hates
some
Paul.
Some people don't. Like Stilgar and Chani still likes him. Still like him.
Yeah, we don't hate you, Paul, but other people hate
Anya
you
also.
Well, very much. So
I don't like you very much, Paul. Like, I am trying very hard to sympathize, but you're not helping yourself by
editing the podcast. So everybody's out to get Paul. The BGs, the T's, the SGs, the F's, everybody's getting Paul. So
there is this conspiracy.
Oh, that's the BGs you meant. I was like, which?
The Space Guild wants to get him. The Telax want to get him.
Not the Fremen
want to get him. Everybody wants to get him.
Some of the friends, some of the veterans,
some of them.
From the jihad.
So there are a bunch of characters who plot in different ways to get Paul off his position. And the thing I didn't like very much is Edric, who is a space navigator. Space navigators are these creatures that can travel through space faster than light, and they need spies to predict the future so they don't crash and die, I guess, so they can navigate through space. So with the power of spice prescience, they travel through space. And this Edric creature has the power to block Paul's visions. Somehow he can make it so that Paul cannot predict what will happen around Edric. And I said in the first book discussion that I really liked how Paul isn't a superhero and it's just a consequence of all the things he's trained for and all the things that like the chemicals are doing and what this training is doing. So this part I don't get it. Like, how is it possible you can block the visions? Like, I don't
No, it's because
spice?
Yeah, it's because like Edric
spice,
also
I
can
think.
See the future. So think about this, okay? If I can see the future, you can see the future, okay? And I can see you in the future, and you can see me seeing you in the future, right? This becomes an endless loop. Because Edric can also see the future, essentially, Paul can't foresee what Edric will do.
But with that logic, shouldn't there be others? Like, every space navigator should be able to do
this. Yeah, but this is true for every space navigator.
But only this guy does it.
Yeah.
Like, No. It's never said that it's only Edric.
Okay, then I mistook it. Okay.
Yeah, the navigators, and it's not just the navigators. Basically, it says later on with the Dune Tarot, with the cards that became popular, that the Tarot cards are making Paul prescient more difficult.
Okay, in that sense, I accept. I thought it was mostly Edric, or somehow Edric did it better.
It's just
that
he's
like,
a kind of a powerful navigator. And also, he's like a fish person.
Yeah.
He is a fish person.
But I could swear that I'd read somewhere maybe not about Edric, but about how somebody became a space navigator. I could swear I had read that in somewhere that was like basically a normal dude traveling with his friends and or like working for the guild with his friends, and then they were like, okay, you're pretty good at this, and they basically like took a human and fed him spice in this he became the
weird
fish creature.
Wasn't it like in the appendix somewhere, like when they described the terminology?
Yeah, it is described somewhere. I can't remember where, but essentially they look like fish creatures because they spend all of their time in space at zero gravity, and they have to live in these tanks which are constantly releasing spice smoke.
Which, if you saw that, if you saw such a creature, would your first thought be, I wonder how you would mate with 100%, such a one?
Yes.
Really? You see that? You're like, I wonder if he fucks and
how. You understand how, how perverted the male brain is. Of course, that would be the, if not the first, the second thing. Yeah,
absolutely.
The first thing might be how does he
poop?
But
us, definitely.
The second
it's just that it was the it was just like this was the one of the first times you're seeing Irulan, and I guess it's through Sytel's Skytel's eyes, and he's assigning thoughts to her, like what is she thinking, and it's like she would wonder about his sex habits, like
I forgot, like the first chapter about the conspiracy, it's all like Sytel reading everyone's thoughts. That was so cool.
Even point 11, that he's the BMF.
Yeah,
I'll start here. Point one. One point. Like BMF.
I will agree with you on that. Yeah. That was one of the coolest things in any villain's like chapter I've read.
Everything that happened around Sytel, I love it. Like I was depressed, but I love it. Love it. Like he's so bad. So Edric wants to get Paul. The Bene Gesserit are conspiring with Irulan, and there is this side plot where they plan Irulan to give some drugs or something to Chani so she wouldn't get pregnant. But the strongest force kind of that's trying to get Paul is the Telaxu, which we haven't talked about yet. I didn't know there's a planet called Telax. Telax. Is it in the book somewhere?
Yeah, well, in the fifth book they... It's there.
Okay. Okay, thanks. So, so Paul is aware of all of these things happening. Like, for example, Chani not being able to give birth. He knows what's happening exactly because he can see it in his visions. But he knows that he's had the vision that when Chani gives birth, she will die. So he doesn't want that to happen. So he kind of wants to postpone it. At the same time, he knows that the Bene Gesserit are plotting with Edric and this is happening, but he can see it all and he's just trying to find a way what can be done about it.
Okay, I have 2 points about this. One, why not tell her? Like, seriously, why not inform her of this fact? Like, look, you know I can see the future. This is what I see happening if you get pregnant. Why not tell her and let her decide if that's something she wants to go through? Like, okay, yeah, we wouldn't have a story if he had done that, but, like, that is a very logical human thing to do, and he is a mentat, so logically he should be able to, like, you know.
I'm gonna say it before you say second point.
Second
the
point.
The reason is that she's a woman, and he decides for her because it's the 60s.
Second point is, and this is something that I saw remarked on about Star Wars, but like Star Wars takes inspiration from Dune, so I think it very, and it very much applies. They have space travel. They have like this unimaginable technology, and yet he sees, hey, my wife might die in childbirth. They have Golas, and his thought isn't, I should get in some doctors and see what could be the issue. Because, like, you know, she is the most powerful woman in that universe. And somehow, they, like, it doesn't occur to them that, hey, maybe we should do some research into this.
I agree. The reason why he can't really prevent it, it's because he can see her dying, but he can't really see how. So it's not necessarily she's dying of childbirth. It's just that she's dying at the moment she's giving birth. So if the reason is that someone is murdering her or poisoning her or doing something, the doctors can't really do much to prevent that.
Doctors couldn't, but if it had been the babies, if it had been complications with the birth, like, you'd think in such civilization they would have, you know, good medical care.
They have no computers.
Absolutely,
so this idea would be preventable.
I took it as the vision doesn't lie, and he's kind of tying himself with that, and even if he did all what you said, according to his visions, she would still not make it, so...
But it doesn't even occur to him. Yeah. Or it's not discussed, you know. Whatever, I don't want to nitpick too hard. This was just something that occurred to me.
He is so enslaved to the predictions that he...
That's what I meant.
Can't fathom the possibility of it failing or it being changed. Because, like, in the first book, he was constantly trying to avoid what he was foreseeing, and he could never do it. And after that has come to be, he's so dejected that now he sees every future as just something to take for granted. And that's also very interesting when it comes to the ending, when he sees that the future can be changed.
So that's another blow to his suffering. He finds out that it can be a different path.
So he could have saved Padme, but he didn't. Because, you know, he was scared and he thought his Yoda told him that his visions couldn't be changed.
Yeah, this is so dumb, like these all these references. I want to talk about how Pablo said that the Matrix movies and Agent Smith is exactly the face dancer, but I don't really want to talk about it because there are better things to talk about. So if you have seen the second and third Matrix movies, and if you have read Dune Messiah, think about it for a little bit, it's really funny. But anyway, let's move on to the Telaxu. I want to talk about that, not Agent Smith. So they have a plan. They are these...
They're a faction, I would say. So within the Empire, there are these different factions, and they all do different things. So there was the, you know, the political power, which was the Emperor, with like the Padishah Emperor before, and now it's Paul. Then there's the religious part, which is, you know, the whole church led by Alia. Then there are the Bene Gesserit. And then there are three other factions which are kind of independent. One is the Space Guild, because only them can travel through space, essentially. And then there are the Ixians, who are the only ones who can create technology. And then there are the Treylaxu, who are the only ones, like, it's an independent faction which focuses on biology, sort of.
Yeah, like bioengineering, genetic manipulation. Yes.
Necromancy.
Yes. So they have this.
Yeah, they're kind of necromancers, yes.
So they are working on this technology to produce Gholas. And Ghola is a resurrected, like just Christina said, a resurrected person, being. And they have made it kind of work. So they can resurrect people now, but they can't resurrect them with their memories or with their, like, full functioning personality.
Yeah.
Or it's not, like, perfect.
Mm. They also have metal eyes.
And they resurrect Duncan Idaho. Woohoo. Super creepy. And the guy behind it is this Sci-Tail guy we already met. And he presents a gift to Paul. And this is points to why he's the biggest BMF. What present can you give to your enemy? Oh, I've resurrected your you know, best friend and teacher and long time, like, master and the best commander.
Hunky boy.
Your boy crush.
And he's a hunky boy. And and now he's something called Height.
But it's like a zombie, basically. He's a Zen Sunni zombie. So I like the whole idea of the Ghola. I was scared at first. I think it's actually a great idea, the way it turns out in the story. I still don't understand why either the Tleilaxu in the story or Frank Herbert, like, as the author, felt the need to make him into a Zen Sunni master. For some reason, now he's like this philosopher, Duncan Idaho, hunky boy.
Yeah, that was weird.
That I part skipped is that. Just, I think, the Telaxu making the gift, like, you know, better for the emperor, like putting sparkly, like topping on it, like to be like, you know, and he's resurrected. And even then, he's even more clever now. He can do philosophy and he can all this. In reality, it's Frank Herbert having an excuse to say all the philosophical stuff. You know,
yeah,
somebody has to
say it. I think so. Duncan Idaho kind of serves that purpose.
Somebody has to say these quotes.
That was a thing, like, that really, I was like, what the fuck is up with this, with Alia?
Yeah, while she was naked.
And, like,
yeah.
Doing that dangerous yes. training naked. And then Stilgar seeing that and being like, we must find her a husband. She is, or she's going to fuck every man in the universe. I was like, what is your issue? Why does she, like, why is that his first thought? And then Paul is like, yeah. She needs a husband, maybe I might fuck her. Because, like, he goes very near that. It's like, what the fuck is wrong with you people? Just, like, they have space travel, but they don't have vibrators in Dune. Like, what is
I
your...
I think he was trying to say, like, how old is she at that point? Is she, like, 18 or something? 15? I think...
I don't know. But, like,
I think it kind of makes sense because I think he was trying to say, because she has all the memories of any ancestor, you know, the best fuck she's ever had, she can remember it. And 100,000 more people, best fuck she can also remember. So, any time she can remember these things, and I bet Reverend Mother X, Y, and Z are like, oh, you're bored, girl. Let me show you what I did when I was your age. And then she gets super horny about it. So she has to do something.
Like, but why isn't she allowed to be horny? Why can't Alia be horny? What's your problem with Alia being horny, Frank? It's just like...
So what were we talking about? So the Telaxu have this Golad gift and they do the worst thing to Paul. Like, they give him his friend resurrected, but he's kind of brain dead, kind of not brain dead. He's spouting out, spewing out philosophy and... then later it's revealed that he's pre-programmed to kill Paul, which Paul can see and knows. So he's trying to, like, you know, what would you do if you were Paul? Would you just kill, hide there, right there? Or would you try to do something with it? Like, I wouldn't kill him if it was my best friend and I was in that situation. Like,
I think he could have just not accepted him. He could have said, okay, well, it's not really my Duncan. My Duncan's dead, so you can take him away. And, like, seriously, what could have happened if he had done that? Like, they would have found another way to kill him.
I think he would have escalated the conflict and he didn't want to do that, like, so he had to accept the gift. Is what I thought.
I think politically it would have been pretty hard to refuse.
Yeah, that's what I meant. So the Fremen hate that, because the Fremen hate the Telaxu, so they lose a little respect of Paul and... It all,
it's like
just
the bar of respect. There's like minus minus Flareman, 1+ Telaxu, 1+ Bene Gesserit, 1+ Space Guild.
I just had a thought of what that would be like to replicate it in the Sims.
Yeah, exactly.
And you said like 1+. I was like, oh, that would be so much fun to like
in
try to play Dune the Messiah, but in the Sims.
Should do that as Let's Play on YouTube channel.
Alia training mate and Paul comes over, and Paul and Stigl come over, and like they get angry and they like stomp their feet.
Maybe someone's already done it.
Don't look it up. Definitely, Christina, definitely don't look up what's behind Dune. It's a thing. Definitely
behind
don't look
Dune?
It up.
What's that?
It's a game. Yes.
Behind Dune, you
I
said?
I think it's called Behind Dune.
And is it on YouTube?
Yes, also. Behind Dune is a text adventure. Yeah, it's called Behind the Dune.
That Dune in particular.
Behind the Dune.
I completely forgot about
it. We already talked about this, Paolo.
I think I can see something.
When the test with the Gom Jabbar comes up, guess what they put in the box instead of his hand?
Yeah. Okay, I remember now.
Instead of his hand, they put in his foot? His foot, surely.
So that's not the only Gola that comes up. There's another Gola called Beaches?
I call it Beaches. I don't know. I just decided that Beaches is the name.
So the Fremen are kind of unhappy with Paul, and there is Fremen Fedaikin,
I think.
It's like a death commando super warrior. And he, so when the universe was conquered under the name of Muad'Dib, then they fought for him. And this is one of the fighters who's very loyal to Paul. And he reveals that there is a conspiracy among the Fremen.
Yeah, one thing though, now Fedaikin, now they went from death commandos to priests, which Paul founds very amusing, in not in a good way.
Yeah, that's messed up. And so I don't remember why, but this guy gives the gola to Paul.
Eric gives
Eric gives Bidges to Paul. Okay, sorry, I forgot who gives what. So sorry. So it makes much more sense, of course. So point three, why Cytale is the biggest BMF. He literally gives another gola to Paul that he cannot refuse. And the whole purpose of the gola is to laugh into Paul's face the whole time and be super annoying and make Paul hate him. And Paul can do nothing about it, and it's super annoying to Paul in all the ways possible. And he knows it's to betray him. He knows it's to do all the bad things. He knows it's like the first thing. And I felt like he almost knew that it's a joke on Paul, like this creature that he got from Cytale. And he still has to go along with it because Bidges is like a computer, basically. So he remembers everything and he can calculate information and he can be proven, he proves to be useful, but at the same time, it's infuriating. He's just following him around. He's like a small dwarf. And I imagine him like the most annoying being ever created.
Yeah, why doesn't he kill him? Besides the prescience, like, yeah, I will
no,
not
I thought
kill
the same
him.
Reason
why
was that he cannot refuse like the gift. He cannot start killing people willy-nilly to escalate the political conflict machinations. And also, he has a use for him. He needs to have somebody to gather all the information for him and process them. So I think there's like multiple reasons why he needs him and cannot flat out just kill him.
Didn't he get him when he went to visit Otiem?
Somehow it's connected with Otiem, the Fedaikin, the commando. I don't remember how.
Yeah, something like that. They're playing some kind of a song and it's supposed to be a catalyst. And
But you're right. Yeah, the old time gives Paul Bijas, the Fedaikin. He had received it. That was the connection.
But is that really the Fedaikin or is that the Leilaxu?
That's probably it.
Because he's not dead.
I think that was it. I think that's happened somehow. But whatever happens, the Leilaxu are behind it.
Yeah. No, Cytale like takes the form first of a woman. Because there's also like Paul is also hearing news about mystery, like this mystery killing, because they found the dead body of this Fremen woman who was the daughter of one of his commanders during the war. That's because Cytale took over her body.
Another BMF point, just willingly takes people's faces on and pretends to be them and has fun with it.
That's the whole point of being a face dancer.
So we get to this attack.
But that's way far down the road. So first, there is the whole like part where Cytale is in a way rising discontent among the Fremen, because we are shown that some of the Fremen now, they, you know, the veterans of the war, are forced to live in this new section of the city. And they have basically lost all of their connection to their traditions and culture, and in a way they're kind of like asking themselves if they had done the right thing to follow Paul. They are living in a situation which in a way is better than before, but it's also, it feels more degrading for them. Chani becomes pregnant. Paul has a lot of visions about the blue moon falling, and finally in the meantime Irulan is always like, well, you know, if you can't have children with Chani, you couldn't have one with me. And Paul is like, no, not going to have sex with you.
I was really surprised by the, at the start of the book, the conspirators being like, or even the X guy, like, the universe is appalled because Paul married Irulan and clearly he's not fucking her. And I'm like, well, that's a political marriage. Like, they happen.
Yeah.
So what? Yeah. Right? I didn't really get why people were like, she's not really your wife. Well, she is his wife.
That is kind of true in the sense that even in history, when there were political marriages, the marriage still was expected to be consumed and to have babies. out of that. And it's also because one trend that you can notice among the conspirators and the other cultures in general is that they don't really have respect for the Fremen. And Chani is a Fremen, so it's kind of like his Fremen mistress.
Yeah.
And so they see kind of as a something that is unbelievable and unacceptable that he sticks to his Fremen, like barbarian mistress, instead of having healthy, Aryan kids with her blonde and blue-eyed white lady.
Yes, I get that, like, a marriage must be consummated, but in general, like, rulers were, throughout history, it was, like, accepted that, political marriages are political marriages. It's like,
It's a matter of image and culture.
In that sense, it kind of makes sense, even though it's not very reasonable. Yeah, so let's get to this explosion. I didn't see this coming at all when I was reading this. I wasn't spoiled in any way. So who made the bomb?
Tabaxo made the bomb.
Okay, so BMF point again. He's behind it. It's called a stone burner. It's basically an atomic weapon. So an attack happens.
Paul realizes what is going on with the death of this Fremen girl. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, one of his men was colluding with the conspirators. So he decides to go there himself to confront this Fremen. He goes to that area of the city and he finds out the truth. But as his soldiers start to attack that area, because that's where Saitel was showing discontent. And so where, these rebel Fremen were living.
Mm-hmm.
It's not explicitly said, but the way I always understood it was that the guy, I'm sorry I forgot his name, but the guy that Saitel was talking to, Saitel took his daughter's face, he was the one to plant the bombs.
I think so.
That's the way I always saw it, but it's not really said explicitly. One small point, while Paul is going to this area, he's going by himself. He has to go through the city. And at one point, he goes through this big office. And there is, like, all of this. Basically, it's Paul saying it, but it is actually Frank Herbert talking about bureaucracy and how much he hates bureaucracy and how bad bureaucrats are and how they, promoting incompetence. And they hate competent people because... if you're competent, you would make the other bureaucrat look bad, and no one wants to look bad. If you take the best quotes among the six books, I think if you make a top 10, at least two or three are from like this passage where it's just Paul going there and in the middle there is this office. My favorite is the one where he says that he's talking about the fact that when you have to do some bureaucratic process, they take some of your time. And that is like killing someone. Because, when you kill someone, you take away all the time that he has left to live from him.
Mm-hmm.
But if I force you to waste some of your time on some bureaucratic process, I'm stealing away some of the time you have left to live. So it's the same as killing someone. It's just a difference in measure and not in nature, which is amazing. It makes no sense, but it also makes a lot of sense. And I love it so much because every time now I go to an office and I have to wait in line and, I think that people are being slow for no reason or are making me do a ton of documents for no reason. I think that they're actually kind of killing me.
Yes.
And that makes me feel so much better.
I'd like to personally thank you for listening to this podcast. Let's move on. Definitely not killing you by listening to this.
No. So yeah, there was a bomb.
But we are delightful. That would not be killing.
But you're still taking the time of people's lives.
Yeah.
I bet you choosing, help them by
the difference is that they are choosing to use their time listening to us.
My bad.
The problem with bureaucracy is that you have no choice. Okay. There was just Herbert's, making a bad joke. Like whole theory. Yeah. Really, really amazing.
That's a good one. Yeah. Definitely for Japan. feel like that very often.
So there is an explosion. Stone burner.
So not only did Zytel undermine the faith of the Fremen in Paul, not only did he put a literal troll on his back to laugh at him like a dwarf, he literally dropped an atomic bomb on his face. Oh my god.
And what happened to his face after the atomic bomb?
Melted off.
Well, his eyes. He lost his sight.
His eyes. But does that stop him?
No.
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 He can see through his prescience.
Too damn powerful. I really like that. I really like that as a concept. Like, of course he wouldn't need eyes to see if he is so powerful that he can... He knows what happens in the future. Of course he knows, like, oh yeah, the tree is falling, so I should move out of the way now because it will fall a couple of seconds later.
And he can pilot an airplane.
Thopters and airplanes. Like, this only solidifies him as a literal god in people's eyes. Like, the people who see him do that, they're amazed. Yeah. They will never think of him as anything else but god, so he makes it even worse.
Yeah.
Like, the thing he's trying to avoid by having people see him like that is just going down the path.
It's also important because the Fremen tradition is that if you're blind, you need to remove yourself from the tribe by walking alone in the desert.
Because you're useless.
Yeah.
So you need to just leave the tribe
in
the desert. So meanwhile, there is just development with all kinds of plotting, namely height and this programming and the trigger to attack Paul and Chani getting sick and worse and the Bene Gesserit and Edric and all this. Everything's bad. Paul is so just in a very bad spot.
So Chani has gone back to Siege Strabr. Which was like the siege that Stiller ruled over in the first book, because she wants to give birth there. And there is this really interesting dialogue between Paul and Hiat, where Hiat essentially admits that he suspects that he might be...
Yeah, I remember that.
He might be the one who will try to kill Paul.
Even Haidt knows that he will attempt to kill
him. So he realizes, you know, I realize that I might be a danger to you. And I don't really remember you, but there is something inside me that doesn't want that. And Paul is like, well, you know, but you're Duncan Idaho. I know I can trust you. And, you know, when the time comes, if you are the one to kill that has to kill me, you won't do it.
So this is another like big BMF point for me, because eventually Paul manages to have Haidt become like an Igaro, to break the programming and recover his memories. And this is exactly what the Telactu wanted.
Yeah, that was amazing.
This is so good. Like, this is this is the plans within plans, like plotting. This is why I think this is the best villain ever. Because they gave him this horrible thing that he couldn't get rid of. He tried so hard to make it into a normal Daikon Idaho person, not to think that's a zombie that's trying to kill him. And that was all that the Telactu wanted.
Yeah.
It's so evil. Oh my god.
Yeah, they wanted Paul to solve their problems, basically. They were like, you know, we can't find a way to make Golas remember things, so please do it for us.
And he does it, and does that gives the Telactu a way to now make Golas that recover their memories as well and their personalities, so because they can learn from this process what happened to Haidt, which literally makes them immortal now, which is so creepy and like the worst thing that the villain could do to this protagonist. Like, this is so evil. Like, I remember reading this, I was like, damn, this is like, what worse could you do to him?
Not only that, but knowing that Chani is going to die, they can tell him, well, wouldn't you want Chani back?
That's another one of my points. And also on top of that, the thing that should have triggered Haidt to kill Paul was Paul's reaction to Chani dying.
Yeah.
That's so evil. Mm. Oh my god.
Yeah.
I was just, I couldn't even when I read that. I was like, how more
you
evil
couldn't
could
even.
You be? Yes. So what happens next?
Well,
is
Chani has twins instead of a single baby. This is the only part where I would go back to Christina's point. They don't have they don't have a scan to see how many babies they're going to have. That's weird. But I guess they have no computers, so
clearly no prenatal care was done.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. The technology in Dune is kind of weird. Like, it's very advanced in some ways, but it's very backwards than others because they have no computers. So, but they should have
maybe
a scanner.
Maybe that's why they don't have vibrators, because they could rebel.
Yeah.
Like those machines of old.
Exactly.
That could be why.
Yeah. Alia, why. Alia definitely would be a heretic because she definitely would want one.
So there's a son and a daughter. Paul didn't see the son coming. Yeah. He saw only the daughter. So he's surprised by that. He couldn't foresee that. And Johnny dies. And now this is like the worst. Again, like Saitel gives the worst thing ever. Like the worst possible thing he can do. There is no choice that can be good in this situation. So he says, we can revive Johnny. Mm-hmm. You've proven it yourself. We can recover the memories now. You can see that in like Idaho. So you, Paul himself, proven them right that they can actually do it. Mm-hmm. Or he can just, you know, kill everybody immediately and have it done with. I guess he can just, you know, kill
the babies.
Or he can let them kill him, mm-hmm, and just be done with it. Like, what do you do in this situation? Anything that Paul will do at this point, mm-hmm, is so bad. And the Telexu... they've plotted so hard to put him in this space. Mm-hmm. That's why I think this is the worst villain in
but
ever.
But the Tleilaxu because... also plotted everything so that he could have one way to escape.
Yeah, that's the thing I want to say, yeah, at the beginning. I forgot. There is somewhere in the book that they say if the Tleilaxu plot against somebody, yeah, they give them a chance to get out of, yeah, it somehow. Which in this way, this case is the worst possible way to get out of the situation, yeah, ever imagined. Which I didn't think this would be also evil, because I thought that point was mentioned, mm-hmm, that there is like a clever way to go against them and escape it. But no, if you choose this, it's even worse. Yeah. It's like they give you an option to get out of this, but it's the worst thing ever imaginable you could choose. Oh my god. Biggest BMF ever. Can't deal with it. So bad.
yeah, also because... So now that the future has changed, as Paul's son is born, he can't see the future anymore. So he can't see anymore. Mm-hmm. He's literally blind now.
Yeah, so even like Paul's, yeah, done. This is so bad. Like this couldn't... worst things couldn't, yeah, happen to
not
him.
Not yet, though. Not completely, completely done.
Yeah. Yes. So he can see through his son's eyes somehow. And he can use that to throw a knife and kill Saitel, which was pretty badass, by the way. It would be a really cool scene.
His son speaks to him telepathically, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's like, borrow my eyes, father.
Yeah.
Then he does.
It's like a whole weird action scene that one-ups the action scene with Alia when she's a child in the previous book. I didn't think they could do something stupid.
Like, like, she was two and, yeah, she was super smart and everything, but... she's still too. She has like small legs and small arms.
It's like
and
such a weird moment.
Body.
And they one-upped it here. Yeah. I don't think they could do that. Like they could have this even weirder. The conversation with the son. Yeah. So Saitel, after Paul refuses to have the Tleilaxu revive his wife, Saitel just takes a, mm-hmm, knife and puts it on the neck of the daughter, yeah, or somebody, or the children, because he knows at this point, what a bastard.
Yeah.
He knows that he can die because he can be resurrected any minute and he can do whatever the hell he wants. So he's just going to kill some children because he's the best, worst.
But one thing though, Saitel was a face dancer, which means he was a slave. The Tleilaxu have this very strict, like the Tleilaxu society is divided into two very strict groups. One is the masters and one is the face dancers. And the face dancers are, yes, essentially just slaves. They are drones, mm-hmm, that they have to do the master's bidding, and the masters can control them via humming, which is the same thing that Bijas was doing with Hiet. So a couple of times, Saitel is kind of being cynical about himself because he knows that he's just a tool for the Tleilaxu masters. So at this point, it's not really that he thinks he can be revived. It's just that his life is kind of meaningless.
Yeah, okay.
Because he's just a slave. And he's programmed to be just a slave. Yeah.
So what happens next?
Well, telepathy
comes. Bijas comes and repeats the offer. Like, because now Saitel is dead. So Bijas comes and he's like, hey, we can still do it. So that Duncan kill him. And then Paul is just completely broken. The Fremen disrespect him. He cannot see the future. Everybody's dead. Yeah, so what else can he do than just walk out in the desert, because now he is useless, mm-hmm. even though he can see it, but there is nothing. Mm-hmm. So to respect the tradition, he hopes that if he does that, the Fremen will respect yeah. him and keep his children as the rulers if he leaves in the desert to die.
Yeah, but okay, I want to say two things about this. The first one is, I don't think this is a negative ending in a way for Paul. Like, the way you're putting it is that Paul at this point is like dead inside or whatever, but I think Paul is actually like, this is actually Paul's biggest win. He finally was able to change the future. He finally was able to get out of this role he didn't want. He was finally able to prove he's just a man, and he found a in a way an easy out by walking out in the desert, because now no one can say he's running away from his duties. No one can say, which is what he has been doing the whole book. Instead of you know, ruling, he was always like going around the city and escaping at night, and Chani was like, "What? Where the fuck have you been going?" And now no one can say that he's running away or he's not doing what he should be doing. And he has given the Empire a future, you know, with the children, and also Alia a role as a regent for the Empire. So this is, in a way, like Paul's biggest win. Of course, if Chani is dead, which, yeah, that's not great. But in every other way, he's, as strange as it sounds, this is a much better place for him to be compared to where he was at the end of the first book. Because at the end of the first book, he had accomplished all he wanted to accomplish, but he ended up realizing he was just kind of like a pawn on a future which was already decided. Yeah. So I don't think this is negative at all.
This is exactly why yeah. I love this book too, because at the end of the first book, you're like, oh, the hero won. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah. And at the end of this book, you're like, oh, this is so bad, and this couldn't have been worse. And then you're like, oh, wait a minute, this is what he wanted. Yeah. Exactly.
Hmm.
And the second point I wanted to make about the ending is that, just from a narrative standpoint and just from a writing standpoint, this is one of my favorite endings among any book I've ever read. Because a big problem with a lot of books, not just fantasy or sci-fi, but just books in general, where when they have several plot lines and several plot points, which are kind of intersecting each other, it's that it's hard to solve all of them, and it's hard to solve all of them at the same time. It's almost impossible. Usually what most writers do is they solve them one after the other. They solve them maybe, you know, in the last few chapters, they move the story between different places, or they move it forward in time so that every, you know, every knot is undone. But they can't really just have a single point where everything is solved. And this book does it, and it's really, really amazingly done.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've never seen any other book which does it this well. Because
definitely a very yeah. powerful ending. I remember
not just powerful, thinking. Just like narratively just so well made. If you take all of the plot points, so Paul's insecurities, the religion, the Fremen, Saitel's plot, Hiat's plot, Chani's plot, all of these different points, they all come together and they all get solved in this single scene. And
this is why I love this series so much. Like you just said, everything comes together. And everything has meaning and weight and depth, so it all...
Yeah, kind of like Hyperion, right?
Okay. So to wrap up the other characters, there is a funny typo in my notes. I wrote Alia excused, but no, everybody's dead. She executed Edric and the Reverend Mother Mohayam. How do you say her name? Gaius Mohayam. Mohayam. But Irulan is spared. Is she a teacher of the children now or something?
She becomes kind of a surrogate mother.
Okay.
Which is like the most humiliating thing. Irulan gets humiliated so much throughout this book. Paul doesn't want to sleep with her. Everyone in the conspiracy makes fun of her. The other Bene Gesserit make fun of her. And, you know, Alia at the end is like, you know, I could kill you like the other conspirators, but instead I'll make you basically into a babysitter. full time.
But I think, if I remember correctly, the next book, like, she doesn't hate it.
No. She's happy.
She loves the children.
She's completely humbled.
Like, she does get a little bit of a happy ending.
So I have two quick things just to wrap up very quickly. Where is Jessica? Yeah. I was thinking about that.
Caladan.
Yeah, she was on Caladan, it is weird that she's never there. She's never thinking, you know, my son is about to have children. I should be there.
The only answer I have is she is a Bene Gesserit, so she knows what's going down. She already had a lot of interaction with Paul in the first book, so she's like, I'm out.
I mean, this could be a point. This. Like in the third book, her loyalty is called into question. Whether she's loyal to the Bene Gesserit or to the Atreides.
She kind of left her daughter right? Because, Paul is an adult. He's doing his own thing. But poor Alia, she's just, she's there to manage
The reasons why Alia, you know, doesn't have the best... Let's say she doesn't have the best way to be raised in the galaxy is because Jessica kind of ignores that goes back because Jessica is a Bene Gesserit and Bene Gesserits don't really like people like Alia. They're like aberrations. Abomination?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, that's true.
What did they say? Abomination. Yeah,
abomination.
They call her like an abomination. Yeah. So she's kind of like, my daughter is an abomination, so I'm off to Caladan.
So the last thing I want to say is more BMF points. I love what Clytale says.
Okay.
And he says at one point that man will die rather than deny his own nature, which I found was interesting. And the thing that I liked the best he said was that reason is the first victim of strong emotion. And he says it like a side note somewhere, it's like murmurs. And then he does exactly what he said instead of having like a villainous speech in a modern movie. And when Chani gives birth and dies, he urges Paul to decide quickly because the body has to be put into this cryogenic tank or something to save it and resurrect into a Gola. So he's planned everything to put Paul at the most stressful emotional point to make the decision and not be reasonable by any means. And he's planned it all. So first BMF ever in all fiction to me. Have I changed your mind at least a little bit about this?
No.
I'm not saying he's not cool. I'm just not convinced he's the coolest ever.
Okay.
It is cool.
Okay.
But his plan is wildly intricate and everything went right, but a thousand different things could have gone another way.
But that's exactly why it's so great. He's so good at it, because how can you win against a person who can see the future and it's the literal god? And he still does it.
Yeah.
But isn't he just a puppet?
Yeah,
and that's maybe there's even a verse bastard somewhere above him.
So he could just be
maybe
doing what...
Maybe I don't
what,
even
what,
know
so,
the
well,
verse BMF
yeah,
that exists.
Yeah, he could just be doing what he's told.
A couple of points about Frank Herbert possibly forgetting things. First, Paul's son is called Leto the second, even though technically he should be Leto the third, because Paul's first son who died and appeared in just two pages. Yeah,
never stop mentioning
he was called
this.
Leto the second. The second one is Saitel, being, as we mentioned, is a face dancer. He's not a master, so technically he's a puppet. Minor spoilers. Saitel appears again in the fifth and sixth book, and he's a Tleilaxu master, but it's never explained.
Okay.
Why or how?
He got an upgrade when they resurrected
him. No, he was
him.
Resurrected, of course, but why was he resurrected as a master if he was a face dancer?
A promotion for a job well done.
He's the biggest BMF in history of everything. That's why he had to immediately be promoted. Well, I had so much fun. Thank you so much for indulging me talking about Tleilaxu. I wanted to talk about it so much with somebody, and every time we talked about this book with anybody, it always gets better. We always talk about this on this podcast. Some books, they get worse talking about them, and some books get dirty. Get better. So this book definitely, every time we talk about it, we find something interesting, a different point of view, different perspective, different detail. I am amazed that this is a thing. And might be also, in me, in my personal experience, like one of the best follow-up to like a really great story that already is something very memorable. The only thing that comes close to me personally is The Speaker for the Dead, which people hate.
Paul hates it.
So this would be even better than that, I guess. Well, Paul hates it, but I got some comments too that people agree with Paul very much. So I'm not sure about that one. Yeah. Okay, so I guess that's it. Anything else you wanted to talk about?
Well, Children of Dune.